My guest today, Derek Farrell, tells us about the two words that made him cry, and Justine recommends an author's second novel that she loved just as much as the first. Hi, this is Brad, and I'm here with Justine.
Hi, this is Justine, and I'm here with Brad.
And this is Queer Writers of Crime, where we feature LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels.
Sounds like a good day.
It's a good start, I think. We'll get there this eventually.
No, we won't. There's a lot of shows that have been on far longer than we have, with far better hosts, and they don't get that part right either.
I don't think I told you, but we had two donors to buy me a cup of coffee, which, as I always say, is very easy to do. There's a button right on your phone there in the show notes. The two people, one was Mark Jacobs, gave a donation. So thank you very much, Mark. And another is a person that was a guest on the show, and that's Garrett Hudson.
Oh, good. Oh,
and
good.
Thank you, Garrett.
I recognize both their names from the internet.
Well, good deal. And they both, when distressed, that they like both of us.
That's great. So. See, you won't have to fire me again this year.
No, at least another week.
There you go.
I'll have to find a replacement first.
Okay.
I've been looking all over LinkedIn.
Mm-hmm. Likely story. So you listen to any other podcasts lately, Brad?
Well, you know, since you've turned me on to podcasts, I've been listening to a lot of podcasts. And I have been chatting with a lot of different podcasters, and we talk back and forth. And if we like each other's show, we say so. And I can tell you there's a lot of shows that ask me to say something about them, and I say no.
They're not shows you like. Not your cup of tea.
No, not just that they weren't my cup of tea. I'm fine with a show that's not my cup of tea. They were more of the quality like we were in the first few episodes.
I see. Well, they'll get better. Check back in a year.
Yeah, exactly. If you call me in a year, we'll talk.
All right.
So there's a new one I've checked out, and I want to recommend it. It's called The Forbidden Apple.
Hmm.
And it's hosted by two friends, Pelayo Alvarez and Melissa Weiss. And Melissa Weiss grew up in an Orthodox Jewish Hasidic home in a very religious environment.
Wow.
And then Pelayo was raised Catholic back in Spain. So as you can imagine, it's also a very religious environment.
Yeah.
Together, they give a voice to LGBT voices, and they explore what spirituality means to them.
Wow. That sounds like a good one.
Yeah, it is a good one. So I suggest everyone check them out. It's Forbidden Apple Podcast, and they are on all streaming. So wherever you listen to this show, you'll find them there as well.
Good. Sounds really good.
And then I need to tell you something that might surprise you.
I don't know. Nothing can surprise me about you, Brad.
No, this is interesting. 2 weeks ago, you gave a recommendation to Double Vice, written by Chris Holcomb.
Wow, I really like that book.
Yep. And I asked you, I said, I know it's the first in a series, but is this the author's first book? And you said, no, I don't think so. He certainly doesn't write like it's his first book.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I looked on Amazon, and unless he's written under a pseudonym, it is his first book.
Wow. It's really great, especially for a debut novel.
Yeah, he came out of the starting gate pretty well.
Yeah. I'll have to track him down, get him on the show. No pressure.
So I think you're up.
Okay. Well, all right. So the author I'm reviewing today, his first book was a great book. I recommended it last year, Fire Watching, on the July 2nd show with Ann Apteker, who wrote Flesh and Gold. He's actually published by a big house. He's Simon & Schuster in the UK and G.P. Putnam here in the US. And that was a terrific book. And I don't always do a second book from an author. Please, if you like the author, pick up the book I recommended or another and then keep reading them. But this one I think is particularly special, and I'd really like people to take a look at this.
And you've also asked several times if people would let you know what they think.
Yes. Nobody talks to me. Only you, Brad.
No, I try. It's my job.
That's right.
So send in an email or leave a voicemail and let Justine know what you think of the book she recommends.
And people do say that. I don't want to let people know that, I have seen comments and I've seen them. So don't feel like I'm ignoring all you people who do tell me what you like.
Okay.
And Double Vice was a particular hit with people. So the second book in the Firewatching series, and I don't know if it's a series, but it features the same characters and it has the same kind of themes going forward. It's called Nighthawking. You know what Nighthawking is, Brad?
No, I don't.
It's the theft of archaeological artifacts from protected archaeological sites in areas under the cover of darkness.
I would never have guessed that.
No. And reading the book, I would have guessed that Nighthawking just referred to a type of metal detecting after dark, but I would not have added in the theft of archaeological artifacts. But that is the premise of this book. There's a group of metal detectorists who go out to a site that's under construction. They pulled down some old buildings and they were about to build some new buildings. And they went out in the middle and they found 13 very old, very rare, very good condition Roman coins, which they decided not to turn over to the government under the treasure hunter's map, partly because they wanted to keep the money. Although if they didn't have the right provenance, is probably worth, they're only worth $8 million. And, you know, if they turned them over, they probably would have been worth $80 million because they weren't stolen. But they mostly didn't want to turn them over because they didn't want to get into trouble for going on to this site and under the cover of darkness. They didn't know quite what the ramifications of that would be. Sadly, the ramifications for not turning it over and for going in the wrong direction ended up in at least one death. And the murder, which starts the case, one of them stumbles upon something that picks up a noise on the metal detector and goes digging and ends up turning up a body. And he takes off. But then when the police come in and uncover the body, they find that there's a skeleton and in her eyes are two of the Roman coins. So that's where we start off. Do we see the points of view from the various Nighthawking things? Early on, you don't know who they are, but as you get further into the book, you start to find out details about it. So D.S. Tyler, who has been in the first book, and all of the various other officers from the first book, at the end, there was a big scene and officers got injured. And it's a year later, and they're all kind of still licking their wounds, one of whom at least is suffering from PTSD and just coming back to the job. D.S. Tyler is gay, though he doesn't seem to have any relationships worth talking about at the moment, and that is the effects of what he's been through. So the book has several mysteries. The body with the coins is one of them. The death of Adam Tyler's father, which was deemed a suicide many years ago, now appears to be a suspicious death, and he's got all the purloined files from his father's cases. His father was also a police officer. And he's still working on unraveling the mystery. And then also in the background is a missing 5-year-old boy who'd gone missing 6 months ago and they just found his body. And the detective that was in charge of that missing person's investigation has been taken off the force under investigation. And there's some intrigue there about just what was going on and why she didn't do the job she was supposed to have done. So intertwined with all that, the book is not a quick read. It's not one of those summer afternoon beach reads. It's quite the epic tale. Give yourself a few nights for it. The writing is glorious. The plots all intertwine together in ways you don't expect. Everything ends up being related at the end, although not in the way you would guess. It is, and there's a lot of danger along the way. And a lot of the same police officers get into some of the same difficulties along the way. There's some corruption in the police force, and that does not get resolved in this book. So I'm really looking forward to the next one.
And it's Nighthawking.
Nighthawking.
And I don't think you said who it's by.
Russ Thomas. The great Russ Thomas, whose debut book was well written, and this one is even better. And, John Morgan Wilson says the second book is always the hardest, but I think he's done himself justice here.
Second book is scary.
Second book is scary, but it's a very well-written book, and it has a lot of details. You get to know the body. First body is found in the Sheffield Botanical Gardens, and so there's a lot of detail, and then the plot takes you to the greenhouses of one of the national greenhouses in which they can recreate the growing conditions of any place in the world. And they grow rare plants under the original conditions. So if you have, say, Africa, the lights up top are burning, blazing like the desert. And there's then another section, there's moisture that comes out at just the right time so that the plants have the same kind of humidity they have out in the wild. And this is based on a real place. Actually, it is a real place. And he does that justice too. I think the greenhouse was not something I'd ever read about in any books, either nonfiction or tourists. Or, you know, I watched a lot of those documentaries on the Discovery Channel. And this was something that I had not really been aware of.
And what do you rate this book?
It's an intriguing recommendation. I cannot recommend this book highly enough.
Wow, you've been on a roll lately.
I have been very lucky with the books I've picked up, I got to say. You know, I tend to, you know, pick up one here and there. Sometimes I put them down. Sometimes I'll tell you, oh, you know, the book I thought I wanted this week, not so much. But the last couple of weeks, I have really enjoyed the ones I've selected.
And I do want to let people know that sometimes we have to put off a recording because Justine says, I haven't read any good ones lately. And then boom, she finds a lovely.
Yeah. So, you know, people don't think I recommend every book I read.
No, that's for sure. All right.
All right. See you next week, Brett.
Interact with other crime fiction fans and authors in our Game Mystery Thriller Suspense Fiction group on Facebook. Links are on our website, queerwritersofcrime.com. My guest, Derek Farrell, is the author of 5 Danny Bird mysteries, all published by Fahrenheit Press. The most recent, Death of an Angel, was published in early 2019. The 6th in the series will be published in early 2021. Derek is married and lives with his husband in West Sussex. They have no cats, dogs, goats, or children, though they do have every Kylie Minogue record ever recorded twice. Hello, Derek.
Hi, Brad. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you on, and I have to start off with one question. Your intro says that your next book comes out in early 2021. Well, you know, it's early 2021.
Yeah, well, I guess my publisher would argue that anything up to Q4 is early 2021. So it was delivered just before Christmas. It should be out by the summer, I would hope.
So it is coming.
It's done. I'm finished. My bit's done. It's down to the publisher now.
Good deal. Now, if I recall, we met on Twitter, didn't we?
Yes. Yeah. That's where we first met.
We were following each other because we were authors, or you were following the podcast. And one day, for whatever reason, I looked at your profile and pulled up your Amazon page. And I was like, why haven't you ever contacted me? And why didn't I ever contact you? What's the deal? So I'm glad that happened. And I'm glad you're on the show.
Me too.
So your Danny Bird mysteries, there's 4 of them right now. Describe to me who Danny Bird is.
Okay. So Danny Bird is essentially an everyman. He's a young gay man living in London. For most of his life to date, he's been sort of doing a sort of a dead-end job as a mailroom boy in a magazine. He's been living with a much wealthier boyfriend. And his life is sort of settled and plodding along until one day he goes into work, discovers he's been laid off because it's the 21st century. No one has mailroom boys because they don't have mail, and gets home earlier than expected to discover his long-standing boyfriend in bed with a window cleaner. And Danny basically just draws a line in the sand and realizes, okay, I've been coasting. It's all been going without me actually controlling it. So he decides to leave. He goes back to his parents. He ends up living in his parents' flat and sleeping in the bunk bed that he last slept in when he was 15 years of age. And long story shorter, he ends up running what's been described as the worst gay bar on the planet. It's a complete dive. And the interior decor is the sort of colour that can only be described as sclerotic lung. And it was last decorated on the Queen's Silver Jubilee, but the Queen in question was Victoria, not Elizabeth. So it's a pretty grim place. And he ends up basically settling in there and trying to restart his life and take control. But he's a character I've fallen in love with, and luckily for me, a lot of other people have as well.
What do you love about him?
His honesty, his ethics, he's smart. He's always able to think of the right thing to say. I don't know about you, but in my case, one of the reasons I like to be a writer is because I hate that moment when 10 minutes after someone's left the room, you think, that's what I should have said to them. But in Danny's case, I can go back 2 pages and put that line in. So Danny's a lot sharper and a lot funnier than most of us are. But mainly it's his ethos. He really genuinely believes in fairness and injustice. And he can't bear to see injustice in any way. And obviously, I mean, that's great for a crime series protagonist, because you tend to get one extreme or the other. You either get the incredibly jaded, world-weary old hack who's just wading through filth, or in my case, you've got someone who is not Mary Sunshine. I mean, he's cynical enough and world-weary enough, but he genuinely believes that if you fight hard enough, you can get some form of justice out of the world. I'm of an age where I remember bars being a huge part of the whole LGBT culture, and you know, it's where people found community. And I know the world is changing drastically. Again, I'm an old fart, so I'm going to say the world is changing, not always for the better. But absolutely, you know, you found your community, but that didn't mean to say that you found sanitary toilets or, you know, dance floors that you could actually move on without sticking like Velcro.
Regarding the gay bars, everybody's talking about the demise of them because people can hook up with the apps. There's still going to be plenty around, I think, because there are times people just want to hang out and dance. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, those who just want to get laid, they're probably going to wear their apps and not go to the bar, but those just want to go out and have a good time, they'll still be around. Just like bathhouses are virtually dead, but there will always be some around because some people like that environment.
Yeah. It's an absolutely valid point. And you can see, particularly in parts of North America where some of the big cities, the gentrification has basically priced out a lot of the bars from areas where they went into because they were cheap and low rent areas. Similar thing is happening now here in London, where, you know, there's a couple of bars I really like that in the last few years have really come this close to being bought out by a pizza chain or whatever. And like you, I think there's always going to be a need for them. One of the challenges we have in London is a lot of the ones on the periphery that are gone. They were the first ones to go because they were easy to get rid of. And they were the property prices were going up, so there was a real sort of land grab by landlords and so on. But in the middle of London, there are still a few. But the question is, after we come out of lockdown and we come out of COVID-19, what will be left for us all? But we live in hope. But as you say, there's all, even if they all go, it's only a matter of time before somebody says, we need a bar, and opens one up.
The Castro in San Francisco, it really has changed. A lot of gentrification there. Yeah, it's still a gay community, but nothing like it used to be. A lot of the bars have become mixed, which I guess there's nothing wrong with that. But losing that one area of community, which disappoints
me. And it's that thing as well where it's like, okay, bars were safe spaces. When they were primarily LGBT bars, they were safe spaces. You know, there's that argument of like, oh, the world is safer, you don't need safe spaces. But I'm not entirely sure that that's true, because there are still people who are made to feel uncomfortable, or, you know, people who are just more secure being themselves, and particularly early on in their lives, discovering themselves in a less mixed environment. But I mean, interestingly enough, death sales pitch, Death of an Angel, which is the most recent of the novels, that's sort of one of the big themes behind that. The area where the bar is located is called Borough. And it's in the it's on the south side of the River Thames. And it was, for many years, a pretty working class area. But the amazing thing is you can stand on this really working class area. There's a major railway station. And let's be honest, the billionaires rarely put their luxury apartments next to a major railway station. But you can stand there and you can see the city of London just across the river. So the billions are there and the high rises and so on. And so it was a lot of social housing. And when you walk around that neighborhood now, the billionaires have moved in. You know, we have Tom Daley and Dustin Lance Black, the guy who wrote Milk. They have their loft apartment there, and there are sort of loft. And it's really interesting. You've got one street is new loft developments that go for upwards from a million upwards. Next street is still social housing. And I was really interested in the way that a lot of the developers are basically trying to make it easier for the social developing people to find somewhere else to go. They can't quite legally drive them out, but they do everything in their power to basically grab the land because it's now becoming more and more profitable. And so there's a whole, well, it's not even a subplot. One of the primary plots in Death of an Angel is a woman who lives in one of the, it's like a project in the States. So she lives in a project, but she goes two streets over and is a cleaning lady in one of the big developments for millionaires who very often don't even live in the apartments because they're just investments. And one night she falls from her balcony. So the question is, did she fall or was she pushed? And if she was pushed, was it because of something that she saw in the projects or something that she saw in the luxury development that she cleans? And yeah, the whole background to that is people basically making land grabs. You would think it's something that happened in the 19th century and, you know, in the Wild West. But wherever there's money, and in London, property is money. So people are doing terrible things to the social classes, basically, to just drive them out. And where are they going to go? Wherever they go, the money will follow. And 10 years, 20 years later, that becomes desirable. So they'll push that, yeah.
Yeah, we have a park here in Los Angeles. It's been around forever, named MacArthur Park. And the park itself is pretty scary to go in, especially at night. And the area around it is very diverse, mostly poor. But the last time I was there, I'm seeing in the middle of these old, rundown apartment buildings that people are living in, brand spanking new, beautiful condominiums. So there's no doubt in my mind, probably in within a decade, it's all going to change. And like you said, where are those people going to go?
Yeah. And it will change exponentially faster because once they start selling those condominiums, the new inhabitants, if they move into them, they're not going to walk out on the streets. You know, they're going to want a Starbucks and a Lululemon's. They're not going to want a bodega and, you know, a local grocery store. So they will quickly find that their rent's jacked up and they go. And then it means that the residents, the residents who've been there their whole lives, where are they going to shop? They don't need yoga gear. They want somewhere that they can buy vegetables and stuff. And it becomes exponentially faster. I mean, we've seen this in so many cities. And of course, half the time, even before the yuppies, the real canaries in the coal mine are the gays who move into the horrible neighborhoods and basically gentrify them and pretty them up and then do themselves out because once they've made it attractive and brought attention to it, out we go. And in come, like you say, the straight couples with a house in the Hamptons. So.
Yeah, we're seeing that all over this country. It gave us a little taste of Death of an Angel. What more can you tell us about it?
It's the most personal thing I've ever written. I can't give it away because it would be a spoiler, but if I never wrote another thing after the last two words in the book, that would be fine. I think the last, well, you know, I can say it because it's not a spoiler. No, I won't. It's the last two words. I found the first two Danny Bird books to be really fun and really easy to write because there wasn't really any pressure. You know, the first one was written before I even considered publication. The second one was half imagined, but not really written. But it was easy. It was fine. The first book hadn't come out when I was writing it. The third one was a little bit more challenging. And by the time I got to the fourth one, it was like, what am I doing with this? What do I want to do? And it was very much the point where I was like, okay, I want to tell a story, but I also want to have a social point, which makes it sound very worthy. It's not. What can I tell you about it? It has the lowest profanity count of any of them. So if you don't like profanity, that's the one to start with. It's an inverse arc. Basically, the first one has all the swear words. The second one, third one. By the time you get to the fourth, I'm able to write without putting an F word on each chapter. There are a couple of plots going on in it. There's the one I mentioned about the woman who falls from a height. At the same time, the pub that Danny runs, which is called the Marquis of Queensbury, which no one's ever picked up on it, but the Marquis of Queensbury was the man who drove Oscar Wilde to ruin. He was the man who sent Wilde the card that saying to Oscar Wilde, posing with a sodomite. So he was not only a homophobe, but he couldn't spell either. And I liked the idea of this old pub being called the Marquis of Queensbury, and it ends up being a gay bar, which is a proper two fingers up in the face of the Marquis. But the guy who actually owns the pub is a notorious local gangster. And Danny, because he's always in trouble with the law, which is what happens when people keep dying around you, Danny has acquired the use of the gangster's lawyer. He's a really petite, mousy, small little woman called Dorothy Frost, who's basically, she looks small, she looks petite, but she's a tiger. And she's incredibly sharp and incredibly good at her job. And she asks Danny to look into the death of a client of hers who came into her office and said, if anything bad should happen to me, I need you to open this envelope. And within a couple of days, the car he was in drove off a cliff and he died. And when she opens the envelope, there's nothing in it. It's just loads of newspaper clippings that don't make any sense. So she asks Danny to try and figure out which of the newspaper clippings is relevant to the death. So he's trying to investigate those two plots at the same time. And also trying to balance his love life, which is going somewhat stale. He's been on and off with this, the pretty policeman. There's a mandatory pretty policeman. I checked the clause. And this guy's basically, they've been on and off, and Danny feels like they're getting stale. So what I've done with Death of an Angel and why I'm so pleased with it is I managed to pull together all the things I wanted to do. And I did it successfully. And that, yeah, I cried a lot, and I cried at the end. And a number of people who have read the book have cried at exactly the same points I did. And I was like, well, how magical is that? I mean, you know, to have an idea and to think, right, I want to write that. This bit is emotional. This bit is sad. But if other people read it and they're like, yeah, it was all right. But if other people read it and they feel sad, you've magically transferred the sad from you to these. And in the next one, I think I managed to transfer some joy as well. But it's a crime novel. It's mostly sad. So what are you going to do?
Yeah, I've found if I'm writing and I make myself sad or make myself tense or make myself laugh, I know I'm on the right track.
Yeah, that's very much. So about a third, somewhere between a third and half the way through Death of an Angel, I remember going downstairs to David, my husband. And so I walk upstairs, he's downstairs. I went downstairs and he's like, well, how are you doing? And I was like, it's shit. And he said, oh, they're all your books are shit at this stage. He's like, you just have to keep going. And he said, you had a really good day yesterday. And I was like, how do you know I had a good day yesterday? And he said exactly that. He said, it's because I can hear you laughing and I can hear the wheels on your chair. I've got a swivel chair. I can hear them rolling across the floor as you kick backwards and forwards, giggling at whatever you've just put down. And I'm like, it's true. When it's good, it's the best job in the world. But when the doubts start to kick in, you just have to keep pushing through them.
Something you said earlier really stuck out at me, and that is you mentioned profanity. Either you or your publisher described this book or your series as cozy noir, which is a strange combination. Explain that.
Okay. Well, we had a debate whether it was cozy noir or new cozy with an N-U. I like the new cozy, but he said it made it sound like new Jack Beat Swing, and that's way out of date, so we're not having that. Cozy noir. Okay. The idea behind it is very much with noir novels, the understanding that I've had, having read hundreds of them in my lifetime, One definition is always it's bad things happening to bad people, which is definitely not this book. These books, there are decent characters in them. But the thing that I love in noir novels is the snappy humor, is the almost gallows humor, is the, you know, terrible things that happen. But if you read a Dashiell Hammett or a Chandler, terrible things that happen, but there's always time for a really sharp description. It might be funny, or it might just be one of those things that makes you go, oh yeah, that's a way of looking at it. I never thought of that before. The cozy aspect is definitely there. So the first adult crime novel I read as a kid was an Agatha Christie. So I love that cozy idea of you introduce your characters, a crime happens. Sometimes it's not the crime that you've been led to believe by the introduction. And then you investigate, talking to all of your characters. And then at the end, it's become a sort of a running joke in the books. At the end of the book, you sort of gather everybody together and you explain, this is what happened and this is who the killer is. And that, believe me, when you've done four or five of those, how you actually writing one and making it even semi-believable that you would gather everybody together. The one at Death of an Angel, I'm particularly proud of, because right the way through it, I was like, I have no idea how I'm going to actually do the denouement on this one, but it happened. It came to me in a dream. So yeah, the cozy noir, they're very much based on that golden age cozy structure. The noir aspect is the use of language, the use of dark humor, and the use of, which is something I think that's very prevalent in particularly golden age noir, the use of the city itself as a character in the stories. And you get that. I mean, again, back to golden age stuff. If you read The Maltese Falcon, it's San Francisco. It doesn't draw you a map of San Francisco. It doesn't tell you this neighborhood is uptown, this neighborhood is down. But you get all of the things that you need to get to taste San Francisco. So it's a character. Even if you look at the Brandstetter novels, which were probably the first gay crime things I read, you know, that sort of Southern California, again, that whole thing, the fact that it couldn't be happening anywhere else. The crimes in that, you know, the sort of the beach, the endless surf, the sort of half spaced out blonde dudes wearing not a lot, but a pair of flip flops. That all just screams Southern California in the 70s. So that for me was the aspect of noir that really I wanted to explore with these books, is the whole idea of using a city as a character in itself. And the one I've just delivered, comes out early in 2021, we don't know how early. And that one, the whole thing is an English country house mystery. So they actually go out of the city, they go to a country house, and the crimes are absolutely an Agatha Christie inspired. But that's still noir, because in that one, there are some terrible people and terrible things happen to terrible people. So I'm claiming noir via that way in that book.
Well, you brought up something that I actually find interesting is you were born and raised in Dublin. You currently live in West Sussex, which I don't believe there's a large city in all, is there? But your stories are based in South London.
Yep. And you want to know, how does that work? Okay. So I grew up in Dublin, and in Ireland, we get 3 months summer holiday every year. My mum had a sister living in London, and normally by the end of the second week in Dublin, I would be bored. I was growing up, it was the 70s. I think other kids figured I was gay before even I figured I was gay. So I didn't have an awful lot of friends. I didn't have a wide circle. I would be bored within a couple of weeks. So probably from about 78, 79, I was coming to London for 3 months every summer. And Dublin at the time was a small, fairly parochial, I won't say backwater, but it was a small city compared to London. So London was always this glamorous place that I was like, yeah, I want to be there. It's glamorous and it's exciting and there's stuff going on. So I moved. So the week before I was 18, I had spent the preceding year trying to get a job in Dublin. There was a terrible recession on. Couldn't get a job, couldn't get a call back, couldn't get anything. My cousin said it was going to be my 18th birthday. They had a present for me. The present was tickets to see Wham! The Final, which was the last Wham! Concert they ever performed. So I came over for a couple of weeks to see that. And by the end of the 2 weeks, I had 3 job offers. So basically, it was like, well, I'm not coming home. I'm going to stay here now. And as a result, I lived in London from 1986 to about 2000. I still work in London. Well, up until last year when we went into lockdown with COVID, I still work in London. So I still go from here to London every day. The bar that the Mark is based on is a bar that I used to hang out in back in the 90s. So I know London. I know all of, I know West London, North London, South London. And I deliberately chose South London for those reasons I said before, because in that neighborhood, you can stand there and look across the river at billions, at the future, at, you know, at all of this wealth and all of this privilege. But equally, you turn the opposite direction, two or three streets in, and you've got social housing with some with not the worst deprivation. I don't want anybody who lives there to be saying you've painted this out to be a disaster zone, but that contradiction, that conflict between one side of the river and the other side of the river, I think was really interesting for me when I started it. And I was lazy. The pub was there, so it was made sense to leave it there rather than move it around. I'm a terribly lazy writer, you'll find.
Regarding Ireland, I'm sure you know here in the States, marriage equality came about. It wasn't a vote. It was based on the Supreme Court's interpretation of our Constitution, which makes it a little shaky because that could always change. What I found interesting is in Ireland, marriage equality became legal because of a popular vote. The reason I bring it up is Ireland is known for being a very conservative country.
Mm-hmm. And it was. Yep. When I grew up, it was a very conservative, very Catholic. You know, I write lines that occur to me in a book, in a notebook. And I was like, okay, I don't know when I'm going to use this one. But I was like, you know, you can't guilt me. I'm a Catholic homosexual. I've been guilted by professionals. and it was when I grew up, partly one of the reasons I wanted to move. It wasn't particularly welcoming. And it was, you know, like people who had jobs still refer to their managers as Mr. Smith or Mr. Adams or whatever. Whereas in London, that hierarchy was sort of not so prevalent. However, Ireland developed at pace. I mean, from part of me, if I'm being really self-conscious, part of me assumes they were just waiting for me to leave so they could start to reform. Because literally within a couple of years of me going out the door, they really changed. So, for example, because the British had been in Ireland for such a long time, they had a lot of laws and statutes on the book, and a lot of ex-empire countries have this. A lot of the laws and statutes on the books were basically Victorian British laws that just never got repealed. And one of them was around the criminality of homosexuality that had been reprised some years before, but an equal age of consent. For example, the Irish government equalized the age of consent several years before the British government did. And the whole voting, I mean, you know, nobody wanted a vote on equal marriage. Both sides of the argument said, you know, we don't want to vote. The pro-equal marriage side said, and I agreed with this entirely, human rights are not something that you vote on because it's a human right. You can't vote that people should be having it or not. The problem they had was the Irish Constitution, which was written a couple of hundred years after the American ones, sort of learned a lesson from the French post-imperial constitution and the American constitution, which were worded in a way that, as you say, it's created industries of interpretation. So the Irish one was very explicit, and it said marriage is X. And in order to prevent future governments coming in and changing willy-nilly aspects of the constitution, they said these things can only be changed following a popular plebiscite, so you have to put it to a vote. So whether you wanted a vote or not, the only way that you could change the definition of marriage was by having a legal vote. And I'm getting emotional now. But yeah, I cried I cried all day. I cried nearly 2 days. I just could not stop crying. And again, I was working in a bank at the time. And I'd been gone from Ireland for so long that it really didn't, I didn't have a say in the argument. But it mattered. It's incredible how you think you've left. I don't want to say escaped, because just to be clear, I had a wonderful childhood. My parents were very loving, very supportive. My brother was a really, you know, we got on like a house on fire. I had a great childhood there. But the school I went to and the culture in general made it very clear that people like me were not wanted or respected. And so I'd moved on. I was fine. I'm living here. It's incredible how it's not until something like that happens that you realize how much hurt you've been carrying around. And I was like, well, if this gets a big no, if there is a sizable no vote on this, then that's it. Everybody who ever bullied me or spat at me or told me what I was and how unwanted I was will have won again. And it was, as I saw young people flying, I mean, you know, the national airline had flights. They had to add on extra flights, because if you were a citizen, but you'd been out of the country for less than a year, I think, you were entitled to go back and vote. And people were flying in from Australia, you know, like a 24-hour flight. They were just coming back. They came back in their droves. There were lots of people working in London, because obviously it's one of the closest places that emigrants will go to. And there were train loads of people going back. And Twitter and social media get such a bad reputation, justifiably sometimes. But on this day, just seeing all the shared, they used the hashtag home to vote, which you can still search on Twitter. Broke my heart. I sat at my desk all day just sobbing and refreshing Twitter. How I wasn't fired, that, I mean, not a tap of work was done, but it passed, and it passed resoundingly. So I was very pleased. The best thing, so at that time, my mum was very ill. I mean, she died not long after it. I think the vote was in the May, and she died at the end of June. So she was in hospital, and my dad was going up and down and up and down to see her. And my dad had left home, and he was like, right, I'm going to go and vote first, and then I'm going to go visit the hospital. And as he's walking down the street, he felt something sort of clip his hip. And he thought nothing of it, carried on. And then out of the corner of his eye, he sees this huge car, like a town car, just mount the pavement opposite and slam into a lamppost, completely cave in the front fender. And he realizes at that point, oh, I've been hit by a car. The driver has lost control, hit me, and then swerved off. Now, most normal people would say, I've been hit by a car. I should probably wait for the ambulance. He was like, I haven't got time for that. I've got to go and vote. So he just like went in and voted. And then I was on the phone to my mother when my dad arrived, to which my mother said, did you vote? Yes. Did you vote the right way? Of course I did. And she then said, did you do one for me as well? Which then led to my father and I having to explain what sort of voter fraud is, and how that you can't go in and do one for you, ma'am. You've got to do it yourself. But I'm not allowed to do it. I'm in hospital. Yes, but it's fine. We'll be okay. But she was insistent that she wanted her vote to count. So the great thing is she got to see that, and she got to see the first draft of the first book. But I didn't get the deal for the first book until 2 months after she passed.
Well, how wonderful she was there to see it pass.
Yeah. She was at my husband and I, we met in a club in 1990. So we're 32 years together this July. And as soon as the UK government introduced what was then called a civil partnership, so again, not quite marriage, but better than nothing, we had a civil partnership ceremony, which my mum and dad were at. And I said, okay, I'm going to buy your outfit, because it's traditional over here. You know, you buy your mother's outfit for the day. So we went shopping, and she was a petite woman. She put on a hat, and she sort of drowned under the hat. And she's looking at me as if to say, well, what's the point of having a gay son if you can't help me figure out what I'm supposed to be wearing to this thing? So I said, well, why don't we try a fascinator? It doesn't block you down. It's not so big. So I get this fascinator, which I think is great. It's like iridescent blacks and blues, and it's got a peacock feather. And I put it on, and she looks in the mirror, and she looks at it, and she looks at me, and she looks at it, and she looks back at me. She looks at it, and she goes, can I ask, is this a gay wedding or a gypsy funeral? It was like, okay, Matt, you pick your own. I'll just sit over here and pay when it's time.
Well, I want to go back to Danny Bird because I'm curious about something. We have four books that are out with a fifth one on the way. Do you know how many books you're going to have? Do you have an arc created for the series? And if so, do you know how in your head how it's going to end?
So the answer is no. And that's partly because this wasn't a series. My publisher's going to kill me now because I don't think they know this bit. I wrote Death of a Diva as a one-off. And part of the process then was that for every single character in that book, I wrote like 10-page backstories. Like, yeah, even there's a guy who has four lines and he's this enormous truck driver who comes in dressed up as Diana Ross one day, and then the next day he comes in dressed as Janet Jackson, 1814, with a beat cap and all that stuff. And he had two lines in the book, but I had his entire backstory. So when I sold this to the publisher, they were like, oh, this is really good. We want this. It's a series. Yep. And I was like, oh, yeah. It wasn't. I had no sequel, no idea. But the great thing was, because I had so many detailed character sketches, I was able to sort of really go back into the world and think, okay, what's the next worst thing that could happen to Danny? What's the next challenge that you can give them? There's a lot of stuff I still want to write about. And I would say the one that's due to come out is a sort of a pivot point, because we've taken some of the relationships as far as they could go in the direction they were going. So it's now time to start figuring out, to start bringing in some changes. This is how you keep things fresh. It's how nobody should get worried. No, I'm not killing anybody off, but it's fun. I'm still enjoying writing these. The readers are still enjoying reading them. I look at the series that I've loved. I mean, I like, there's a guy called Lawrence Block who wrote a series with a detective called Matt Scudder. And they haven't ended. You know, Lawrence Block is in his 80s now, and he says himself numerous times he's not planning on doing any novels because they're too much to do. But you just know if a great idea came to him, he would go back to it. And then you look at someone like Armistead Maupin with Tales of the City. He came to a point where he was like, right, Tales of the City is done. There is no more to be said about Tales of the City, everything I need. And then he came back, and actually the new books, looking at these characters all these years later, are in some ways even better, because they're really sort of they're challenging the preconceptions of the readers and the characters themselves. So for me, I've got character arcs. I've got a couple of books ahead on character arcs, but I've not decided, okay, there'll be six books and then I'm done, or there'll be 12 books and then I'm done. I don't know. I mean, who wants to put a number? There are some authors who are 20 or 30 books into a series. And as long as they stay fresh, keep going.
Well, I love that you mentioned Lawrence Block, who is absolutely my favorite author. And I'm amazed how many people have never heard of him, because he's outstanding.
Huge. But again, funnily enough, I was obsessed with the Agatha Christies and the Dashiell Hammetts and so on. And I went to a course on crime writing. And the first night they got, as an icebreaker, they did that exercise where we're in a hot air balloon and we're losing altitude, so we need to throw something overboard. So each of you has your favorite crime author, and you need to make a case why they need to stay in the balloon. And mine was Agatha Christie, and they threw her overboard first. And I was like, what are you, Philistines? You can't throw Agatha. But somebody who I had just met that night made such a case for Lawrence Block, who I had never heard of, that I went out that weekend and bought the first two. I bought the Matt Scudder and the Bernie Rodenbauer, Bernie the Burglar. And the Bernie Rodenbauers are very influential on the Danny books, because they are a really kind homage to those classic golden age crime stories. There's always a denouement. He always manages to get them together again. They have a lot of humor going through them. They have a lot of pop culture references going through them. And Caroline, who is Bernie the burglar's sort of sidekick, and I just, oh my God. Yeah, so Caroline, who's his sidekick, is, you know, sort of a lesbian, but it's irrelevant to the stories, mm-hmm. to be honest. It's referenced in passing, but the stories and her character is not about that. It's just part of her character. And as I finished the script, I realized that Danny's sidekick is also called Caroline, and I realized Lawrence Block is probably on the phone to his lawyers right now, threatening me with all sorts of theft and plagiarism. But it was, I'm going to call it an homage, an accidental homage, but they were definitely influential, his stuff. And I met him, must be nearly 20 years ago now in New York. They used to do this book fair down Fifth Avenue. And I used to spend a lot of time backwards and forwards between London and New York. And so I knew he was going to be at the book fair. So I dragged my husband and our friend. I was like, right, we are going to walk the length of Fifth Avenue till we find him. And my husband still laughs to this day. He's like, so we found, like, my husband will tell this story. He'd be like, okay. So we found Lawrence Block, and Derek pointed at him. Like, the man was sitting 2 feet away. Derek's pointing at him and saying, you're Lawrence Block, as though Lawrence Block might have Alzheimer's and not be sure who he is. And apparently Lawrence Block was very, very kind, but I completely blank the whole thing. I have no recollection. I was in such excitement and shock that I basically pointed at him, said his name, got him to sign something, and then said, I love you, and ran away, which was just mortification, but there you go.
Yeah, I don't want to get too much into Block because I want to talk about you. But what I really love about Block, and something I hope to aspire to be able to do, is the Bernie the Burglar series is light. There's a lot of humor in it. And then you turn around and he has the Matthew Scudder series, which is very dark. Yeah. And they're both incredibly successful. He did them both really well. That's my aspiration.
The thing I aspire to is the humanity, because that's why his books work, is the humanity. He genuinely cares about all the people, and even the villains. And I try to do this in mine as well. Even the villains have a story. There's a reason. You know that you get told this in creative writing classes. No one thinks they're the villain. Everyone thinks they're the hero of their own story, which is nice but trite. But the way that I've sort of turned that into something that works for me is exactly by realizing, well, what is it that drove them to what they're doing to this crime? And that's very much one of his things as well, is even the villains. You don't necessarily feel sorry for them, but you understand the background.
Well, we've reached the point in the show for awkward questions authors get. And with this, I've interviewed dozens of authors to get questions that they've gotten that are either strange or difficult to answer. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to spin the wheel, and we're going to see what you get.
Okay. Now I'm worried.
Okay. Do you like Asians?
I love everybody, and I love everybody equally, and everybody loves me. Who's asked that? Well, an author was asked that question. Yes, I do. I can't believe anybody would actually ask. That's such an American question. America's obsessed with race.
People didn't give me the reasons why they were asked that. My guess, and this is a total guess, is they probably had not had Asian characters in their novels. That's the only thing I can come up with.
I dread that, because I actually realized in the first two books, I killed far more women than men. And I thought, oh, someone's going to accuse me of, you know, sort of like it's some sort of the living out of some repressed fantasy or something. And so I think by the time I got to the third, I was keeping a tally so I could go right. So I could at least say, look, it's evening up. It's coming. But yeah, people do tend to read things into it. I mean, I tried with these books. This was one of the things I wanted to do when I referenced earlier using London as a character. one of the brilliant things about London, and one of the reasons I wanted to live there and to sort of move away, Ireland when I grew up was white and Catholic and very patriarchal, whereas in London it's multicultural. It's, you know, like everywhere, there isn't a, I don't think there's a country on the planet that doesn't have some race issues. There's a lot of historical stuff that needs to be addressed, but it is multicultural. It's open, it's vibrant, and it's a small city, so people do have to live cheek by jowl. You know what I mean? You don't necessarily get the opportunity to have the Asians live over there and the Afro-Caribbeans live over there. We all basically intermingle. And I love that, and I've tried to bring that into the book, into all of these books, without doing it gratuitously. Yeah, absolutely. The answer to that question, if you then turned around in response to a question like that and said, no, I'm going to put one in the next book, I think that's even more offensive. Mm-hmm. Because it's just shoehorning, and it'll be done in such an unresearched, unconsidered way that that will be justifiably more offensive than not having a particular group represented in the books.
Yeah, I use a lot of diversity in my books, but that's because Los Angeles is very diverse, so it'd be strange not to. But I've never said, it's time for me to put somebody from this nationality in there. You know, it's just a natural part of the flow because of the city I live in.
Well, the third book, Death... Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
The third book, Death of a Nobody, which is basically my take on Agatha Christie meets Guy Ritchie, because it's all about sort of faded gangsters who are sort of pensioned off gangsters, one of whom did a runner years before with the results of a jewel robbery, except his body is then discovered in the basement of the pub. So the question is, well, if he didn't take the takings, who did? And in that, one of the gangsters is a Chinese guy who is a notoriously vicious gangster. But by the time the book starts, he's dead. So you do have his widow, who has a unique dress sense. She turns up to the funeral dressed like a Victorian waif, with a big stovepipe hat and a veil. And it was, someone said, I write monsters, but I make them human. And so I wanted to make this, you know, she's got all the money in the world, but absolutely no idea what to do with it, because, of course, most of it came from very questionable means. So she can't be seen to splash it about too much, because the police will start sniffing around. So she buys ludicrous outfits that cost a fortune, but make her look like she's in fancy dress. And that was my little tip of the hat. But again, that made sense, because there was the idea of a notorious gangster being Chinese in this country, that you got gangsters from every race, so it wasn't me sort of shoehorning in. It just came naturally in that case. But now the question will be, why are the only Asians in your books criminals? So thanks.
Well, to remind the listeners, this is Derek Farrell, and he's the author of the Danny Bird Mystery Series. His most recent book in the series is Death of an Angel. And as usual, I will have the links in the show notes. And remember, if you read Death of an Angel, which you should, don't skip to the end and read the last two words. Start from the beginning.
Yeah. You'll enjoy it, Matt, more if you read it consecutively.
Thank you, Derek. It's been a pleasure to have you on.
It's been an absolute blast, Brass. Blast, Brad. Thank you so much. I nearly got away with that slipping over my tongue once, but thanks, Brad. It's been wonderful. Thank you.
Be sure to subscribe to Queer Writers of Crime wherever you hear our show. Tell a friend, too. Thank you for listening.